WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Commentators have been all over President Obama's inaugural address. While many found it forceful and lyrical, others said it was unmemorable. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg agrees with that view, but doesn't see that as a bad thing.
A modern inaugural address is sort of like an Olympic equestrian event, where the course and maneuvers are precisely spelled out and the points are awarded purely for style and execution. Obama's speech certainly made all the required moves, a few biblical allusions, a nod to Tom Paine, a shout-out to Jerome Kern. But it really wasn't particularly memorable. If we still lived in an age when people put together collections of great speeches for pupils to memorize and declaim on national holidays, it isn't likely this one would be included. The editor would more likely go with a moving speech that Obama gave in Grant Park on the night of the election.
If there is anyone out there who still doubts that America is a place where all things are possible, who still wonders if the dream of our founders is alive in our time, who still questions the power of our democracy, tonight is your answer.
But actually, I'd count the speech's unmemorability as one of its strengths. Ceremonial speechmaking is an unnatural, anachronistic exercise, and I'm not sure whether anybody could ever again give an address as memorable as Kennedy's in 1963 or Roosevelt's in 1933. People cite Reagan's 1981 speech as the best since then, and it certainly counts as one of the clearest. But its language was unremarkable and even hokey at times. The only line people remember from it is "government isn't the solution," which worked much better in the version that Reagan had been using on the campaign trail since 1975, where he added the snapper, "government is the problem." In fact, when you reread Roosevelt and Kennedy's speeches, you realize how rhetorically remote their age was. Take the famous sentence from Kennedy's inaugural that begins, "Now the trumpet summons us again, not as a call to bear arms, though arms we need, not as a call to battle, though embattled we are, but as a call to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle," and so on for another 25 words or so. It's still a stirring line, but you can't imagine any recent president trying to get away with it. Kennedy was the last president who could comfortably dip into the stew of classical figures of speech. "Not as a call to battle, though in battle we are," that would be both chiasmus and polypteton. Rhetoricians have been botanizing this stuff for millennia, and by now there's virtually no way to put two words together that doesn't have a Greek label, preserved in aspic by generations of English department pedants. The medieval scholars called those figures of speech the rhetorical colors, from a Latin term for ornament. They flourished over the centuries when the proper role of literature and oration was the decorous ornamentation of thought, and when politicians and poets drew from the same rhetorical well. And you can still turn up moves like that if you rummage around in T.S. Eliot or Wallace Stevens. But rhetorical ornament is alien to the spirit of modern literature. It still survives in some religious traditions. It comes naturally to a Jesse Jackson or Joseph Lowry, though it sounds a bit forced coming from the energetically affable Rick Warren. For the most part, though, these figures are reserved nowadays for advertising slogans, bumper stickers, and the titles of country songs. They're the linguistic equivalent of stunt writing. Take the figure of speech in Kennedy's "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." The classical rhetoricians called that anti-metabole, though modern speech writers tend to refer to it as the reversible raincoat. Politicians are still irresistibly drawn to it. Bill Clinton had his "people are more impressed by the power of our example than the example of our power." John McCain had "we were elected to change Washington, and we let Washington change us." And Hillary Clinton went with "the true test is not the speeches a president delivers, it's whether the president delivers on the speeches." That figure of speech has roots in Shakespeare and Blake. It's in Kipling's "What Should They Know of England, Who Only England Know?" And Frederick Douglass used it when he said, "You have seen how a man was made a slave, you shall see how a slave was made a man." But to modern listeners, those lines are more likely to bring to mind the syntactic two-step of slogans like, "When guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns." Or in its purest classical form, "Starkist doesn't want tuna with good taste, Starkist wants tuna that tastes good." It's as catchy as ever, but it can't be the vessel for a deep idea anymore. Of course, Obama's speech was dotted with some of the other turns and classical figures that ceremonial addresses require. A nation cannot prosper long when it favors only the prosperous. That was polypteton, or using a word in two different ways, as in FDR's Nothing to Fear But Fear Itself. It was a tidy turn of phrase, but you had the sense Obama could have done better. And there was a soupçon of catachresis in the bitter swill of civil war and segregation, which Obama read with a rising intonation that evoked Martin Luther King. But Obama didn't do a lot of rhetorical overreaching. He did just enough to nail the event. No, it wasn't a speech for the ages, but I found it reassuring that he kept his coat on right side out.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley.